garbage collectors. Well, this might bring to mind big, burly men in smelly coveralls who noisily wrestle with garbage cans in the early hours of the morning. There's also a software equivalent of this, which is a lot less smelly and virtually silent. Today's guest has made a name for himself by being the driving force behind the garbage collection infrastructure within the Common Language Runtime. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Patrick Dassault, technical fellow in the .NET Framework Group. I hope you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Patrick Dassault joined Microsoft in 1994 as part of the Visual Basic team. His interest and involvement in computers and programming languages, of course, starts well before then. It was in 1981 that he received his Master of Science degree in Computer Science and began his career at Schlumberger, soon getting involved with a variety of Lisp projects there. In 1984, he joined Texas Instruments to work on the TI Explorer Lisp machine and stayed with them until they divested their Lisp efforts in 1988, following the overall failure of Lisp machines in general to prove commercially viable. Next, he moved to work at Lucid, which had started as a Lisp company but was now working on an object-oriented IDE for C++ called Energize in an order to reinvent themselves as a C++ company, which they viewed as having a stronger future. Due to poor management decisions, however, Lucid ran out of steam and money in 1994. With many years of programming language architecture under his belt and experience with a variety of different projects, Patrick went to work at Microsoft. The previous year, 1993, Visual Basic 3.0 had been released and hailed as a great success. It was while working on VB that Patrick and a small group of friends created JScript and VBScript over the course of a few weekends. His next weekend project was to create a cleanroom version of a Java virtual machine. This project ended up turning into a more serious endeavor, and Patrick was tapped on to lead this team. It was through this work on the JVM that Patrick and others realized that it would be unable to provide the necessary flexibility to support other languages, have the deep interop with COM, and unmanaged code. A better way needed to be built, and it was this effort that eventually became the Common Language Runtime, the core of all .NET programming languages. And this is where Patrick has been ever since. Join me now as I welcome, as today's guest, Patrick Dassault. Patrick, it seems like you've had a rather interesting career focusing on a bunch of different languages at different companies and stuff like that. But the question I always like to ask my guests is, how did they first get involved in computers and computer technology?
Right. Well, I was very early. I was about 13, and I heard about computers. They had computers in the space programs, and they were talking about it. And I remember asking my math teacher, so can you tell me what a computer is? He says, no, it's too complicated. You can't, very few people know what computers are. And so I decided to go to the library and then root for some books. And I found books about computer hardware and didn't find anything about software at the time, which was kind of interesting. But so I bought that textbook about computer technology, and it talked about logic gates and core, memory, and then I read all of this, and I was very interested. Say, okay, how do you make computers out of it? What's the heart of a computer? And then I finally stumbled on a book about the Babbage and the Turing machine, and I say, oh, okay, I understand. Babbage thing is kind of logic gates together, but and then I looked at the Turing machines, and I understand now, yeah, I got what a program was. So the next step was actually to get my hands on a computer. And we had a local university, we had an IBM 5053 or something. It was some kind of a COBOL machine. But they had a Fortran compiler. So I went to see a professor there and says, well, I'm not going to help you, but here is a Fortran reference manual, go with it. And so I read the Fortran reference manual. I was all confused about libraries. What the hell is a library? And it was like talking about sine, cosine stuff. So I said, oh, I learned about sine, cosine, so I'm going to do a trigonometric table. And that seems simple enough. And then I go there, and they put me on a card punching machine, which had the wrong card. It had the COBOL MasterCard instead. So the card punching machine had a MasterCard, and that would define the character set. So the mapping between the keys and the punch code. And so since they were mostly a COBOL shop, then they didn't have a Fortran one. So my first cards were unreadable, and then I figured out how to map between the COBOL character set and the Fortran. And it was at the time where I convinced my math teacher at the time, which was smarter than the one I had before, to actually visit a computer center and expose people to what computers are. And so while they were talking, I was typing my code, and then at the end say, oh, let's try it out. And it worked. So I came back with the listing of the sine cosine table, and I was hooked. Then I tried to steal computer times there, and then I was kicked out when people discovered that they had to wait because there was some kind of Fortran task running, and said they had to load the Fortran compiler and boot out the COBOL out. And so then I found a BASIC machine, a Wang BASIC machine, which was unused in some other place of that university, and I started to write utilities for teachers to grade people and get average and compute the curve and stuff like that.
That's one way to improve your college score and stuff like that. Just make sure that your name is
Patrick
A.
And then I got into APL. I knew a guy who was at the engineering school that I ended up joining. And I studied in an APL, which was kind of very, very different. Exposed me to a very different way of seeing programming.
People don't even use APL anymore, I don't think, do they?
I bet that some accounting companies still use it, because IBM actually pushed it as an accounting language. And their first personal computer was an APL machine. And it was used as a more of a counting thing than a scientific.
Because that had that weird character set and stuff like that.
Right, exactly.
That's one of the few languages I never actually took the time to learn, because that looks all Greek to me.
Yep. And that was my first exposure to runtime systems that are more than BASIC. And it was interesting. I actually wrote part of a garbage collector for APL. And that's where I realized that there was a big difference between the surface syntax and the surface semantics and the implementation. Mm-hmm. And APL traditionally is very wasteful in computer resources, because essentially what you do is you process whole vector at a time. So if you want to get, usually you expand a problem into indices, then in parallel you compute all of the operation on all indices, and then you shrink them back. And sometimes something could be iterative, and instead there you parallelize it essentially, and you materialize usually the whole data structures in parallel instead of one by one. So like computing the next prime, usually you just materialize one, and then the next. In APL, you materialize all of them, and it's wasteful. And then we worked, when I was at the computer science department, I actually didn't take many classes because I was exempted from classes, but I went and did research.
Because you wrote the program that allowed them to set who's exempt from class and stuff like that.
For engineering school, because I actually read all of the textbooks beforehand, so they knew I knew the material, so I just would go to the exams. But I worked with the researchers there, and they were working on a APL implementation, which was fairly cutting edge, and they had the guy who created APL actually spend a few months at our school. And so he started a project and we worked on it. And the project was all about trying to do the symbolic representation as opposed to materializing the entire data structures. For example, the IOTA, which is one of the core of APL, which is it generates a vector of ordered integers from 1 to n. So IOTA n is from 1 to n. And instead of generating this, we would just remember it's IOTA n as an opcode. So anytime then you add plus 1 means you add 1 to all elements. So there, what we normal runtime, APL runtime, would just generate the entire array, keep it in memory, and then plus 1, it would just add all of 1 to all of the elements and then generate a new array. Instead, we would just do that symbolically. And we remember that we had an IOTA n opcode, and then we had 1. And then when somebody wanted to have a slice of it, then we would just compute that. And actually, we would generate a code on the fly when the expression was complicated just to get the answer. So the idea is we would keep the computation symbolic. Then when somebody really needed the answer, we were stuck, we had to materialize the answer, then we would generate the code when it was complicated or interpret it when it was simple. So that was my first experience about intelligent runtimes, if you like, things that there is a lot of cooperative work that the compiler can't do, and there is a widely accepted practice that APL can't be compiled. And APL can't be compiled if you don't have an intelligent runtime that actually does a lot of the work. And that's where I learned the fact that, yeah, we had interpreted languages and we had compiled languages, but we didn't have many languages for which you compile part of it and then you have a good runtime that actually takes up the where the compiler left off. And that left a fairly deep impression on me.
And so then all this information you've been gathering about Lisp and the differences and the right programming environments then led up to you taking and dealing things with like C#, the CLR, Visual Basic,
and stuff like that. For us, I mean, the CLR and the JVM essentially are intelligent runtime where we try to strike a balance between what can be done at compile time and what should be done at runtime. And the essence of the CLR, of managed code, the part that if you take any of it, it doesn't respect what we need, is the essence of runtime type safety. And that's really what I deeply care about. The rest is kind of extensions, in my opinion. So runtime type safety means that the compiler will try to prove that any location in memory that you use, be on the stack or on the heap or anywhere, is actually used consistently, is read and written in a type consistent manner. So you can't alias an integer and say, no, now it's a float, and I wrote it as an integer and I'm reading as a float. That violates type safety. And with type safety, you have strong guarantees you can on top about securities, because there are things that if most security bugs are actually about being able to subvert memory to your own purpose. To, for example, you have a read buffer that's supposed to contain data about a payload, and instead you repurpose it to execute code. And so the payload that you put in it is actually executable code. And then if you somehow convince the machine to execute it, then you get a security attack. So the trick is how can a compiler actually completely prove and completely enforce type safety? And generally, you can't, because if you can, and for example, Pascal, I believe, could, you have a very restrictive runtime environment, and there are many programs you just can't write. And actually, even Pascal wasn't type safe. I remember looking at LaTeX and at Tech, and Tech was written in Pascal, and I got the source of it. And then I'd never seen before. There was a union, and the union was an int, a float, and something else, in right in the interpreter of tech. And they would write an int and read a float. And that's because tech has actually an interpreter, a numeric interpreter inside to compute margin and stuff, so you can have mathematical expressions. And in order to write their interpreter, then they had to have essentially these places in memory that could be of any kind. And that, so it's not even type safe if you allow unions in the language that are untagged unions, where the compiler doesn't know which side of it was written. So bottom line is the compilers actually can't enforce type safety on their own. So what the CLR does is it allows a certain level of type safety, and then it leaves to the runtime and it describes to the runtime what we should expect, and the runtime enforces the rest of the type safety. So essentially, for that, by the way, you need a garbage collector, because you can't let people delete memory imperatively, saying, oh yeah, I'm not using that, because some other part of the program could still be using it. And then you can repurpose the memory by reallocating it. And now you get type safety violation, because a part of the memory could be used as a buffer when you first allocated it. You delete it, somebody still uses as a buffer, and now you use it to represent code, for example. Mm-hmm. And now you get two people having a different idea of what that common area of memory is. So you have to have automatic memory management where you allocate, but you let the runtime figure out when it's safe to delete, to reclaim this part of memory. And it's traditionally called garbage collector, but it's an automatic memory manager. Yeah. So no, it's now we are starting to build what a minimum runtime is. And it's a part that knows how to enforce type safety, and it has an automatic memory manager. And how do you enforce type safety? Well, we have to have a representation at the deep level of what types are. So essentially, you have each object have a type ID, and usually the type ID is stored in a place where we can also store the virtual methods that can be called that are dynamically looked up. So usually it's called vtable. So we can store, essentially the type ID is stored in the vtable, and there is one vtable per type, if you like, and so that can be reused.
No, so it's hard to talk to people that know you very well without the concept of garbage collection being one of the core things they always mention about you, because that seems to be almost what you're famous for, of enforcing the concept of garbage collection in the CLR, in C#, in VB, in the different languages we have going on.
Right.
Clearly,
so VB
clearly
is another garbage collector, which was interesting.
Yeah.
And I grew up with garbage collectors. I mean, turns out that some EPL didn't have one, but then we had one in our implementation of EPL. And so I learned about the difference between people doing reference counting and the people doing garbage collection. And then VB had a reference counting mechanism, which was exactly the same as SCUM. And you couldn't tell the difference in VB between a COM object and a VB object. They were one of the same. And actually, the VB instances were COM objects. So it was a world where you could get into cycles and you couldn't reclaim cycle, which is the main problem with reference counting. And actually, we had bugs like this in around forms. People couldn't close their forms because they had in VB4, because they had circular references. Most of them, actually, we fixed because they were in the system rather than in the user program. But the user program could also have them. And when we worked on VBScript and JScript with the small group of us, then the first reaction was to use, garbage collecting is complicated, so let's use reference counting. And one of the guys said, yeah, but if we want, we are going to reference count everything, including stack. So, and say, I bet I can, you know, by the time you get your thing working, I'll get a garbage collector working, and it will be faster than your thing. So we said, okay, fine, you're on.
So a little and then, contest going on between
you
and the weekends.
And I was later than he was. He actually coded faster than I did. But at the end, his stuff was about 20 times slower because he wanted to have no... We had only an interpreter. The compilers can remove a lot of address and release by proving that it's a temporary variable and it knows exactly when it's going out of scope, so you don't need to address release it. But when you have an interpreter, it's actually not possible. So if you want to do a very good job of it, you have to waste a lot of time address and release. So I had a conservative garbage collector, which means that the garbage collector doesn't cooperate, doesn't get cooperation from the runtime, and it tries to guess. So whenever a bit pattern on the machine looks like it could be an address, then it says, oh yeah, it's an address, and means somebody is pointing to it, and the part of the address that is pointed to then needs to stay. And so we had that in JScript and VBScript. And it's still, I mean, actually, the same one is still there in JScript for IE.
I mean, you know, some of that debate still goes on today of whether you want to can do address release
exactly,
or you do garbage collection.
Right. And that was one of the bane of my existence for, I don't know, maybe 4 years where they had that debate was going on. A guy who was in VB took over VBScript. And when I left to lead the Java group, we had JScript and VBScript. And they were the same implementation. And then they got handed out to two different groups. And the guy who took VBScript was coming back from a leave of absence, so he knew nothing about it. And then I was trying to explain it to him, and then he was okay. And then at one point, he stormed in my office, and he was very angry. And he said, I realize what you just said. There is a garbage collector in it. There is no address and release. He said, no. Oh, but it's VB. It's insane. It's bad. And it turns out that, in a way, there is things we couldn't do because COM was in the way. And he found the only bad example, which has a byref coming from COM, which actually doesn't work as it worked in VB. It did something... Okay, but you had to program slightly differently. So a program that was written for VB as is wouldn't work in VBScript. You actually wouldn't get your value back. You had to code it slightly differently.
So then did he end up removing the garbage collector?
Yeah, then he took it out. And then VBScript became 2x slower than JScript. And that was the end of it. And
so you actually won in the end, yeah.
And I don't care, but you know, at this point, I mean, that was his product, not mine anymore. Yeah. And then JScript stayed with the garbage collector, which is, it's conservative, so it's not really optimal. Yeah. And then in Java, the Sun Java had a conservative collector, and we started with conservative also because we were trying to get to a conformant implementation of Java before a conference, and we had like a month to do it. So we worked like crazy, and I think the Mike Tutonghi finished the coding in the back of a cab on the way to the airport for the conference, so he was still debugging the damn thing. So we had a very simple collector there, and then I said, well, we need a better collector. So we started working on a truly state-of-the-art collector. And I enlisted the help of a friend. He worked at Symbolic, so we were competitors when he's David Moon. He was one of the founder of Symbolic. And we worked in the Common Lisp community, and my job was to make our machine, which was slower hardware, as fast as the Symbolic machine by just making better programs, and his job was to prevent that, but he was also doing a lot of other things. So, and at the time he was just laid off from Apple. He was in the Tesla's group at Apple Research on the East Coast, and so I said, well, why don't you do some consulting for me? He said, working for Microsoft, are you nuts? It's like Windows, I don't want to do that. Say, oh, but it's working with me just for a new thing, okay? Just, I want you to tell me what are the best practices we should use for a state-of-the-art garbage collector. Say, my experience with GC, state of the art one, were all on very specialized hardware at the time. So, and I know he had researched the implementation of GCs on normal hardware. So he came back and we had a lot of design notes. So I said, oh, here's how, you know, the technique that looks the most promising are these. And we discussed, and there's a whole bunch of suggestions. And we took some, the core one, the core data structures of that forms, the core of GC are pretty much the way he wanted them. And then we had lots of stuff that actually we couldn't make work with enough speed about our object model, essentially. So our object model stayed the way we designed it because other implementation were slower.
In addition to having, you know, like the whole concept of garbage collection and how that deals with managed code, another aspect of managed code that we dealt with a while back was involved with Windows itself and the operating system. Back then, we called it Longhorn, but right. I now realize there's a whole internal debate regarding whether or not Longhorn was going to have managed code or not have
right.
managed
so
code.
Right, so at one PDC,
and we've actually got a quote here from Chris
okay.
Broom,
okay.
where he takes and he talks okay. about that a bit.
Obviously, there was a point during Longhorn where we went from deep embedding of managed code to a lot less of that embedding, largely because of issues that we were running into where we really weren't ready to put the runtime deep into the operating system. And, you know, that was a change of direction that affected a lot of teams inside Windows. And obviously had the potential to be a politically charged issue. And during that period, Patrick became a member of the Windows Core architecture team, kind of sat with them and worked with them through those issues. In the end, you know, the right decision was made. And I think that although it had the potential to kind of cause tensions between the two teams, because of the way he handled it, and of course the way the Windows guys handled it, I think we ended up with a much better shared understanding of what we would have to do in future releases and kind of a shared vision of how managed code might be appropriate down the road.
So managed code in the operating system, that's obviously, as we saw there, it was a big deal back then, and it's still something people are debating.
Right. Right. So, as I said, there is managed code, and then there is the CLR. And that's what I was talking about, what's the essence of managed code. And the essence of managed code is something that, if we can implement it properly, is something that the OS would like. And that's something that I had a hard time working through with CoreArch is essentially when they reject the CLR, what do they reject? And that obviously it's politically charged because there is one group, DevDev, is putting a lot of effort and into this unified product that we try to make work anywhere. So we, you know, servers, essentially all of the Microsoft servers now run CLR, no question. I mean, every new development on server area, like even Exchange, use managed code, no question. We have LOB apps, line of business apps, Fortune 500 company. I think we have like 60-70% penetration there. And then, but with a single product. So we have one download and it's everything and people are doing okay with it. So essentially our identity as a group in DevDev is around that single product we have. And then Windows, when they realized that we had problems and they had problem using it, also took the attitude of saying, yeah, CLR is no good and, you know, we don't want managed code. And but then part of what I did for a long time is trying to understand what don't you like about managed code. Saying I don't like managed code is fine, but is it the way we implemented it? or do we have deeper problems, for example, garbage collection? And it's interesting because I've fought the garbage collection versus ADREF release for a long time at Microsoft, maybe 4 years. And we had, I don't know, I probably spent more hours meeting in this single issue than any other issue I ever had at Microsoft.
I mean, the same sort of issues of like, what do you do with the operating system that's existed for years? I mean, it used to be you could only write an operating system in binary code.
Right.
You couldn't write an operating system
in C++. And part of it was teasing that apart and say, what don't you like about managed code, about the CLR? And we found out that a lot of what they don't like is actually because the CLR itself was never designed to sit very low in the OS. So we take dependencies on fairly high level part of the OS. Actually, even the CLR unmanaged runtimes has dependency on the UI, not because of our fault, but because it turns out that the OS has the security library calls into the UI sometimes to ask about certificates. And we need security and encryption, and so we link with it. And then at the end, we look at the dependency chain, and we have to sit very high. And on the other hand, there are people doing intercepting create file, which is one of the, it's in kernel 32, it's very low in the OS, and create file was tunneling back and calling into a managed process. And create file has expectations that, you know, it needs to be robust, it can't shut down a process, it needs to work pretty fast, and now we had some kind of unpredictability, maybe because that other process wasn't available at the time, and so those are actually architectural problems that are about layering. Essentially, what we would like is we'd like to have an OS that is properly layered. Doesn't mean it is right now, but we're working towards it, where the lower layers are rock solid, and they are very primitive. They just expose the raw OS objects. And then on top of that, we build some higher level, more user-friendly code, and we still have an expectation of reliability. If memory is scarce, then we return an error instead of blowing up the process. And then we go up, and that we go into services, wouldn't it be great? It's actually services will die when we are low in memory instead of hanging around like they do now and sucking the memory, and then your machine is unresponsive for 20 minutes after the memory becomes available again, just because instead of dying and recreating themselves, they just hang around. So at some level, you need to change the way apps behave. And it's better for an app to actually die and recover. And so it's better for an app to actually spend engineering time in recovery rather than just not dying. And so those are layerings. You can see that there is a logical layering for each layer as its own property. So with these properties, you can say, okay, now which language should we use for these layers? And the answer is not black and white. It's depending on the layer. So I spend a lot of time trying to work that through. And at the end, actually, even in the layer, the user mode layer, such as create file, people said, yeah, but, you know, if we had, maybe actually managed code could work if we had a small implementation of it, which we don't have right now. But we have a unpolitical, a very objective measure of where the CLR can sit and what it would take to bring managed code down layers and how we could make progress.
So
and that was important to us.
It's to take and try to focus on what is managed code doing today and what does it need to do tomorrow. So how can we make the CLR
exactly
become
so the first step was to actually understand the problem area. And I believe now that we CoreArch and we have a very good understanding of what layering logically should do and what properties and what tool we should bring in the future. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be an interesting exercise in the future to try to see if we can actually get that essence of runtime type safety and apply it to the lower level of Windows. But for sure, we are not trying to shove the CLR into the lower level anymore because we understand exactly what the pitfalls are there. Mm-hmm.
Now, in preparing for this interview section, we talked to a lot of the people that you work with. And there's one sort of bit that, I don't know, could be called a sense of humor, perhaps, that they all, every single one mentioned to you, including Chris Broom. Let's hear what he has to say about that.
Well, so I don't think that Patrick's the practical joker type. But the one thing that everyone else gets a kick out of is that he largely categorizes the world into two groups that he changes the names of from time to time, but they're usually losers, or as he would say, losers, and idiots. And one of those two groups isn't as bad as the other, but I can never remember which group you want to be in, but it's kind of necessarily the case that you're in one of those two groups.
So Chris mentioned you kind of change your categories from time to time. So I got to start off saying, what is the current categorization you've got set up?
Yeah, so the categorization actually is we have normal people, which is most of us, people that are competent at their jobs. Then we have clowns. And clowns are people who are not evil, but they don't have a clue. So like when I play tennis, I'm a clown because you know, I don't have a clue, but on the other hand, I don't hurt anyone. So that's the, essentially, there is limited negative effect on your environment. Then you're a clown. And then you're a loser when you actually have a negative effect on the environment. So somebody who, you know, just can't get an intersection right and sits in the middle of the intersection and block the entire grid is a loser, okay? And then we have complete losers, people that just do that for a living, and that's the only thing they know how to do. So that's the official characterization.
Now, in all the reports I was reading, not a single one mentioned normal people as being one of those categories.
Well, because that's a default.
I would think maybe
it's not worth mentioning. Everybody, So when somebody becomes a clown, means he doesn't have a clue there about something.
Yeah. So and are you actively constantly taking and deciding which group people fall into?
I think the groups are movable. People are clowns in some of the aspect of what they do. Say when I play tennis, I'm a clown. So we say us clowns. I mean I have no. And then, however, when I go to work, I hope I am a normal person for most of the time. I think we were clowns when we were trying to push the CLR in Windows without having a clue of what their problems were. So, you know, we were clowns at the times. And so it's really movable, and it depends on, you know, how competent you are in what you are doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Now
and we have very few. I've actually met very few losers.
Very few, okay. Can you name any?
Well, not at Microsoft. Actually, what I love about Microsoft is that everybody is at least a clown in what they are doing.
Seeing any red noses out there in the audience? So, the fact you don't got anything above a normal person, that kind of says there's really nothing to aspire to other than being normal?
I think the level above, like De Gabriel says, winners. But to me, I mean, it's everybody wins. I mean, it's hard. I think I respect everybody who is a normal person in their job. I mean, for me, it's not. I don't really distinguish above that. I mean, when I enjoy talking to people, you know, it's that's where it's at, and that's what's great about. When I work at Microsoft is when we have meetings, even if we do disagree, there is a lot of respect. And I when somebody tells me something, I intuitively, most of the time, say, he knows what he's talking about. Therefore, he's giving me information. He's not giving me suspect information. He's giving me real information. So I need to understand what he says. And if I don't agree with the conclusion, it's not because he's a clown, it's because sometimes it could be if it's real. I mean, I've got people, you know, over the years, they would come in my office and say, hey, I'm going to tell you how to write a garbage collector. And, you know, I would do that, you know, I would spend 6 hours every day just thinking about how to do it better. And then there is a guy comes to my office and say, oh, I thought about it for an hour. I'm going to tell you something you don't know. So usually then the clown beats turns on and say, and say, yeah, that's, you know, not going to be, and it's never been the case ever that somebody came to my office and gave me, you know, an idea that was interesting. I got ideas by people who had a different attitude, were pointing to a problem and say, hey, you know, for example, I did the first implementation of a scalable MP collector that we had in the industry. And it came because Mohsen told me, well, you know, that garbage collector thing doesn't work. I say, what do you mean doesn't work? Yeah, because it won't work on servers, because servers have multiple processors, and then you, like, you know, you get an application, it's taking, you're running on multiple processors, and then you choke it during your garbage collection phase because you have only one processor working there. I say, yeah. And I said, okay, yeah. And then I tell him I should learn more about exactly what servers do and say, well, servers, yeah, they actually process uniform requests, usually very uniform, and that's why they actually can be on several processors fairly easily, because those requests are isolated from each other. So you can start on one processor and it's going to be fine. And then you can switch any random processor based on load for the execution of this request. I say, okay. Ah, it's interesting. So if I could replicate, take advantage of this property, I'm not going to do a general purpose SMP collector like many people have done, because those are actually end up fairly being inefficient in the scheme of things. So I wanted something that was very efficient. Say, oh, if I could take advantage of this property, then I can actually write something that is naturally isolated. And so I won't have much crosstalk between my collecting threads, and it's going to work out. So that was the basis for our server GC, which is not a universal SMP collector. It's actually a server. It's designed to take advantage of the workload where we have several requests and they are essentially independent from each other.
So then,
having a discussion, what led me to this, not somebody telling me, oh, here's how you should do it.
But it's actually sharing information and being progressive.
Right. Yeah.
So if you're taking or classifying people as normal clowns, losers, complete losers, have you ever thought about categorizing concepts? And if so, what is garbage collection and what is ad ref release?
Oh, I see. I never thought of this, but I think concept is really hard to categorize because there are multiple facets to them, and there are places where that's applicable and places where it's not. So I think ad ref release is a very simple concept, and that's what's attractive about it.
So it's not a scalable or a loser then?
Well, that depends on which aspect you're talking about. If you want to implement something in 2 days, then you would be a clown to use garbage collector because you can't implement one in 2 days that with all the infrastructure that make it work well. So, but you can do an ad ref release. If we want something that scales to black boxes where you don't have to trust implementation as far as you can throw it, then you'd be a clown to use ad ref release because you know it's not going to work. You know people are not going to do the right thing, and you can't trust somebody else's code to actually implement release correctly. And so there you don't do that. Mm-hmm. So I think concepts, they are never completely bad, otherwise people forget them and we wouldn't talking about them. So concepts have their own
They escape the model.
Exactly. Well, right. They don't know. They escape by disappearing. So there are a lot of concepts like fifth generation. I don't know how many people remember that, but okay, that's forgotten. That's not you want, and that's because you know these guys are garbage. I mean, there is a wide area of concept in computer science that just got completely buried, forgotten, just because that was stupid. And then the concept that we keep talking about, then they have some merit, and that's why they stay as concepts.
Okay. Well, then now we're going to switch to another part of the group where we're actually going to ask you some specifically targeted questions, and the audience is also going to have a chance to take and ask you questions, which I'm sure they've all been dying to ask you as this conversation has been going on.
All right.
We've had a fascinating discussion with Patrick so far, and now's the time where we take and have a certain set of questions we ask all of our guests. Don't worry, you're not going to be scored on this. So the first question is, what advice do you have for people in your field?
So by my field, you mean software design engineers who write code, which is what, even though I don't write much code anymore, but I still feel very attuned to, I think the advice I would give them is that they have to become experts in the particular narrow field they are in before trying to go wide and jump from one field to another.
Mm-hmm. So focus on something.
Yes, and I think when we have meetings, we always trust the experts. And we achieve consensus, but we have to have the information. And I always have tremendous respect for people who are experts. And I know I'm going to ask a question. I know who is in that field. And if I trust the answer, you know, we make the right decisions. If the answer is a maybe and is not trustworthy because the person doesn't have enough in-depth knowledge about the area, then we can't make, not necessarily, I mean, he's a clown if he has no clue. If he has a partial clue, he's not a clown, but it's, we won't make the best decision because we don't have good information. So I think that's extremely important for me, is to know somebody breathe and became an expert. So I'm going to ask and I'm going to trust the answer.
Okay. How would you describe your work to someone who is not technical?
So if we had one of my son when he was in high school, he'd say, "Oh, my dad, he collects garbage at Microsoft." And then, you know, the friends would come over and say, "Well, you have a nice house. So how do you become, you know, collect garbage at Microsoft? You know, it seems to pay well, right?" And so, but given my current job, I would say it's more maybe urban planner. Essentially, what we are trying to do is make sure that the assets we have at Microsoft live in a good life for a long time. And that means they have to be based on good foundations, and we have to have room for growth. And it looks like, you know, urban planning. I mean, you are not responsible for the design of each house, but you want to make sure the house are not too close together, that you know, you'll have spaces for parking, you have spaces, and the utilities are not going to be all choked. So having that general goodness about having strong foundation, how we grow them, how do we evolve them, is these things that right now I spend a lot of time on.
Okay, thank you. And then in life, what would you compare to producing software?
So I think producing software is exactly like, I mean, it's engineering. And I thought about it and I can't tell the difference between engineering for an airplane and engineering for software. It turns out that software was the first one to use computer-aided design, which is kind of assemblers. And so, but at the end, at the beginning, people would write down and design, and they would have things that were written down, and then people would code them on machines. And then we'd say, okay, why don't we use programs that actually toll text editors and assemblers that actually will take that? And computer-aided design for airplanes was kind of the equivalent. Instead of having people, you know, trace manually and then repro them, and then we get, you know, numerical control machines and CADs. And so essentially you transfer a file from the place where you created to another place where it's being produced. How is it different from what we are doing? We are doing the same things. And I believe that the design challenges we have in engineering, which is make trade-offs under a number of conditions to achieve a product that achieve a certain area of fitness, is very analogous to designing a car or designing an airplane, where at the end you need to sell it a certain price. You need to have meet some kind of criteria for performance, for usability, for appeal, compared to the competition, compared to the state of the art, and you need that to do that under a budget for engineering, budget for production. And we have the same constraints. The only constraint we don't have much are in terms of production. Even though when you think of the difference now, distributing program on CD-ROM is not that valuable anymore. So even the production part of it is evolving, and it makes the design for producibility change. So when people design on the web, for the web, it's actually it's a different production model, and that's why they changed. So in a way, it's really about engineering, and engineering is engineering.
Okay. Finish this sentence. You know you're a computer nerd when?
When you can't read your own handwriting because you are typing all the time instead of writing.
But, you know, don't you think that's a common problem nowadays with anybody? I mean, even, you know, email between, you know, grandmother's
right,
taking
the
typing.
I think the U.S. society is really high-tech, and I think everybody becomes nerds, which is, not bad, I think.
Okay, so the last thing we do is we ask everyone to draw their favorite data structure and explain what it is. So now is your chance to... Now, granted, it's not a keyboard, so I'm not sure whether you can read your handwriting or not.
Yeah, you can write the lines, but not. So I would actually take binary trees, and in particular, binary trees that are used for sorting. And one very nice property of these things that people don't normally know is you can, if you have you have an incoming packets of nodes that you want to distribute on a binary tree, and these are actually ordered monotonically, you can design an algorithm that is very simple, and I can produce a perfectly balanced tree at the end. And that's it's a very interesting problem for you to think about and solve. The answer is simple. The thought process to get to it is also interesting. And actually, we use that internally in the collector. So it's also practical.
Okay. Yeah, can you go ahead and sign it? Might be worth thousands one of these days.
Yeah, sure.
To your mom.
Not even.
Okay, so that's the end of my questions.
Okay.
And now we're ready to take and get some questions from the audience.
Okay.
Who's got a question in the audience? You've got a question? Yeah.
So we talked a lot about your interest in your code and all the work stuff. Can you want to educate us about interest in fast cars and how that has changed over the years?
Sure. yeah, I got my first Corvette in 85, and that was pretty good. That was the first car that I had that had really, really good handling. And it was in Austin, Texas, and they had a lot of curvy back roads, and it was really fun to go into the hills area on back roads and learn how to drive pretty fast. It also I-5 on between Austin and Dallas provided, say, some interesting straight. And at 6 in the morning, there is no one there, so it was also doing pretty fast. And I've had Corvettes ever since trying to keep up with the technology. When there was a significant leap in technology, I would actually buy a new one. So the next one was when they had 300 horsepower engine, and then the one after that was when they had 350 and had a new generation. The one after that when they had 400, the one after that when they had 500 horsepower. And then here I got involved into road racing on the track, and that's really fun. Essentially, the track hosts number of cars, and you have rules. You don't pass cars only when they let you in some certain area, and your job is to learn how to drive it properly and to get a very good lap time. And that's very mental as well. It's kind of interesting. You have to physics is key there, except when you are at the wheel, you have to make very fast decisions, then you can't reason about physics at this point. But you can reason about physics off track and then visualize the track and say, oh, something weird happened there. Oh, yeah, that's probably because I did this and I did it wrong. So the physics agrees with this. So next time I'll probably force myself not to do it again. And you get better and better. And the track is a very reproducible area. So it's like testing. You're in a condition. You don't have a dog running in the front of you. And so you can repeat your experience time after time and then get better at it. Then you can get variations. You can get like car breakdown in front of you and stuff. And then when you're good enough, so you can handle that.
So how is your lap time these days?
Pretty good.
Thank you, Patrick, from the Techno Community Network for being our guest today. And thanks to all of you in the audience for coming.